You're going to love this. Just love it.
I've heard that before. We'll see.
I fall off my chair, and I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio's KPFK in Los Angeles, this is your broadcast, as heard on 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in San Diego, 99.5 FM Ridgecrest and China Lake, up in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast, 106.7 FM KSO in Cozy Cottage Grove, 93 FM WLRI in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 88.5 FM, KAKU, the voice of Maui. And, of course, coast to coast and around the globe via kpfk.org. Streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, The Awesome Radio or Not, Radio Free Brooklyn, Grateful Dread Public Radio in Nashville, and, of course, Radio Sputnik 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us today for, yes, another action-packed thrilling adventure here on the Bradcast. Great to have you with us. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker may no longer be running for president. So you can celebrate that if you wish. But the fallout from his 2012 recall election is still wreaking havoc, not just in Wisconsin, frankly, but potentially to our electoral system nationwide, as millions of dollars are being spent by who? Yes, you guessed it, the Koch brothers and other right-wing groups who are using that state, using the state of Wisconsin, the great state of Wisconsin, the Badger State. They are using that as a battleground for the idea, and buckle up, the idea that there is not enough money in politics, dark money and otherwise, dark money from groups who don't have to name their donors, and that there is not enough currently illegal coordination between campaigns themselves and these right-wing groups, actually all groups, who are funded by these unnamed individuals and corporations. And now these groups are relying on a Wisconsin Supreme Court that is itself quite literally, and I'm not exaggerating here, quite literally bought and paid for by those very same groups, counting on that court to help them set the precedent that we must get rid of all of these troublesome laws and stuff around elections, the very, very few laws and stuff that remain on the books, to allow more of all of the above in our electoral system. It sounds amazing. I realize that we've been covering this this developing story for many months now, almost years at this point, actually. But what happened last week in Wisconsin in this story, while the nation and the world was looking at San Bernardino and then at, you know, the GOP politics of fear and fascism ever since, what happened last week amongst all of that Sturm und Drang, which has done a fine job of obscuring what's going on right under our nose in Wisconsin, that is likely to have a very big effect on elections nationwide. As I say, we've been telling the story for some time. It's been ignored by much of the media, at least the corporate media, at least the non-right-wing corporate media. The right-wing media, they are paying close attention to this story. They really are. and they're reporting it, and they are lying about it, as usual, to their customers. So we're going to be joined momentarily by Brendan Fisher of the Center for Media and Democracy to discuss the latest almost unfathomable shoe to drop in this ongoing story of the attempted criminal prosecution of Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker and his very powerful right-wing cronies. It's an amazing story, and I want to leave plenty of time for that, and I want to leave plenty of time for Desi Doyen and the Green News Report, because Desi Doyen, good day.
Hello.
We did not get time for your latest Green News Report yesterday.
I know. We had so much to talk about yesterday that the fate of the world has to wait.
Yeah, the fate of the world has to wait. As usual, environmental news, the redheaded stepchild of the news business, waits till the end, and then we run out of time, can't cover it. So we are going to cover it today. I gave you a big tease on it yesterday, and then I couldn't cover it. So no tease today other than to say, well, you know what? There's a bit of quite good news, I think, in today's Green News Report that we didn't get to play yesterday. So we're going to get to that today. And so to do that, I'm not going to let you, Desi Doyen, go on one of your unhinged rants that go on and on with no reason, no rhyme, no reason.
Yes, I do that so often.
You got to stop that. So we're going to make this opening segment a short one, I hope. You'll actually stop me from one of those unhinged rants, Desi Doyen, if I go
it's
on.
It's a deal.
So very quickly, let me just hit a couple of very quick points before we get to Brendan Fisher. One is... something's going on at the New York Daily News, and it's a good thing. It's a very good thing. Following the San Bernardino massacre, we talked about it on this show, their front page, their cover of this tabloid in New York, and this is the Daily News, not the New York Daily News, not the New York Post, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch of Fox News. This is the Daily News, and they have been coming right out and saying things that I wish many in the media had said long ago. We probably wouldn't be in the various soups we're in had they said some of these things long ago. But they came out following the San Bernardino massacre last week, calling out those politicians, I think pretty much every single one of the presidential nominees on the Republican side who called for thoughts and prayers. Thoughts and prayers for the victims in San Bernardino. The New York Daily News described them as cowards who could end gun scourge, yet continue to hide behind meaningless platitudes. Great big front page cover that said, God isn't fixing this. It's great. Great to see it. Glad to see it in New York. New York Daily News. Then, I think it was the very next day, they then called out the National Rifle Association's Wayne LaPierre. He is their mouthpiece, their face, the face for the NRA. We've been calling him out for years. We've been calling out the NRA as the terrorist-supporting, terrorist-enabling NRA. And the New York Daily News came out and said, put a big picture of Wayne LaPierre on the cover and called him a terrorist for their support of, their lobbying against legislation that would close the terror gap that, for example, allows people on the terrorist watch list to walk into any gun store, buy any guns or explosives they want. They can do it at a gun show without a background check, just as Al-Qaeda has been telling them to do, literally, for some time. So New York Daily News called out Wayne LaPierre for that, called him what he is, a terrorist, or at least a terrorist supporter. They called him a terrorist. And then today, in regard to Donald Trump, this fantastic cartoon on the cover of the Daily News. When Trump came for the Mexicans, I did not speak out, as I was not a Mexican. When he came for the Muslims, I did not speak out, as I was not a Muslim. Then he came for me. And it shows a cartoon of Donald Trump with a great big saber in his hand, and he has just beheaded the Statue of Liberty. She's lying on the ground. He is holding her head proudly by the crown, right on the cover of the New York Daily News. Thank you, New York Daily News. Good job. Thank you for calling these people out as we should call them out directly, because frankly, the corporate media holds a lot of responsibility for the mess that we are now in. Maybe, we'll see, maybe they're turning a page. The Detroit Free Press on Wednesday reacted to the country's increasing state of Islamophobia, which, by the way, could not have happened had the mainstream media not allowed it to happen over this past decade or more. They posted a front page editorial condemning Republican politicians, including Donald Trump and Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, a Republican, for perpetuating anti-Muslim bigotry. The editorial headlined, "We Stand Together," criticized the base built up by the so-called establishment Republicans in the past 50 years. Trump's soaring support reveals harsh truths about the party base that so-called establishment Republicans have built with fear and bigotry and xenophobia, with the notion that a fictitious former America should be our ideal. Ignoring the reality of life for women and minorities during that so-called golden age. And most harmfully, by perpetuating the idea that success for others, particularly non-white, non-Christian, non-heterosexual, non-male others, means that they will lose. The editorial read. It's a false equation, they said, but one that has given Republican candidates significant traction among some demographies. This is the subtext, they say, for the last 50 years of Republican politics, fear and hatred. They go on to criticize Michigan Governor Rick Snyder for his rhetoric that they say is more measured than Trump's, but is rooted in the exact same tacit endorsement of bigotry that says any Muslim could be a threat. Both men legitimize hatred and their words to dangerous effect. That has been done by not just Trump, not just Rick Snyder, but all of the Republican Party at this point. Those who say Donald Trump is some kind of out of line with the Republican Party. He's more extreme than the rest of the party. That is absolute nonsense. Donald Trump is channeling exactly what the Republicans, Fox News, right-wing talk radio, and yes, the Republicans have been pushing for years, and now the Republicans are just horrified, horrified that he's saying it out loud, not just on Fox News, but everywhere. They're appalled by it. Well, no, they're not. This is their base. This is now who they are. But the news flash is they could not have done it without the mainstream corporate media allowing them to do it for so many years, allowing the false notion of a right-left paradigm that is the same, a Republican, Democrats, they both do it, they both have their problems, they're both equally bad or equally good. All of that is stuff and nonsense. And maybe the media are now finally calling out that party for what it is. I can only hope. Anyway, I promise not to get too deep into this. We will return to this topic, I suspect, very soon, but I want to make sure we have plenty of time for Brendan Fisher and whatever the hell is going on up in Wisconsin, because it's amazing, and yes, for Desi Doyen and the Green News Report. All of that is straight ahead right here on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned. Brother. Oh, Scott Walker, is there no end of astonishment you can bring to me and bring to your state of Wisconsin? Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com with you here, and this story just gets amazinger and amazinger. We keep following it month after month after month. It doesn't seem to make it really into the national media, but I think that this story is probably the most underreported yet overly important story on a national level that just is not getting the national scrutiny that it deserves. Maybe it is in Wisconsin, but not on the national level. Now, So we have a new part of the Scott Walker saga here that took place last week. And this was, of course, buried amongst the huge news week. It was another huge news week, obviously, over the past week. I think I say that at this point once a week. But it was a huge news week with the shootings and so forth. Well, little noticed was Brendan Fisher's article over at PRWatch.org, which is the website for Wisconsin's Center for Media and Democracy. He wrote, on Wednesday, the Wisconsin Supreme Court's majority contorted itself to find a new way to protect both Governor Scott Walker and the state Supreme Court's biggest supporters, not to mention itself, following its decision in July rewriting the state's limits on money and politics and ending the John Doe investigation into Walker's campaign coordinating with dark money groups. That ruling last Wednesday, he writes, was supposed to be a straightforward decision on a motion to reconsider an earlier decision by the court in light of additional evidence that Scott Walker and his allies violated the campaign finance laws that the court had upheld in July. The court denied the motion, but then in a lengthy unsigned opinion, and this is where it's even more amazing, they went further, rewriting their July decision to fire the Republican special prosecutor. Let me repeat that. The Republican special prosecutor who had been appointed to lead the investigation of Scott Walker and his coordination with these right-wing groups. The prosecutor was a man by the name of Francis Schmitz. And the court's decision made it harder for him to challenge the state Supreme Court's decisions and their conflicts of interest. The justices on the state Supreme Court, their own conflicts of interest, it made it very much more difficult for him to challenge their decision up to the U.S. Supreme Court because, well, by and large, Francis Schmitz has been fired by this court decision. Schmitz, who is a retired U.S. Army colonel and former counterterrorism prosecutor, said that about this entire affair, he said, "The miscalculation I made in this investigation was underestimating the power and influence special interest groups have in Wisconsin politics. My career in the military and as a federal prosecutor fighting violent criminals and terrorists did not fully prepare me for the tactics employed by these special interest groups in Wisconsin," Schmidt said in a statement. The decision on Wednesday by the Wisconsin State Supreme Court was, quote, extraordinary, according to a former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Geske, who now teaches at Marquette Law School. She said, "To somehow remove the lawyer representing one of the parties after the opinion has been issued is extraordinary. It puts the case in a very odd situation, removing counsel so he cannot file an appeal. There is now no clarity for how other prosecutors might be able to intervene and make sense of all of this." So to, if you're having trouble making sense of all of this, so am I. Here to help us make sense of it is Brendan Fisher, the general counsel at the Wisconsin-based Center for Media and Democracy. Brendan, welcome back to the broadcast.
Hey, Brad. Thanks for having me back.
Every time I have you on, I have to express how exasperated I am by this story because it seems to get more and more insane by the moment and yet still doesn't get the kind of coverage nationally that I would think it deserves. And we'll talk about why I think it deserves that in a moment and see if you agree with me here. But let's try to explain what it was that I just butchered so much. We've had two investigations of note, the John Doe investigations, as they're called in Wisconsin, right? Those are similar to a grand jury investigation in that they're carried out in secret, but they're carried out not by a grand jury. They're carried out by a special prosecutor. Is that correct?
It's actually by a judge. So instead of a grand jury or instead of an impaneled jury making a decision about whether there's sufficient evidence to or probable cause to bring charges against somebody, it's overseen by a judge.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, because it was so because the violations of campaign finance coordination were so wide ranging, they appointed a special prosecutor, somebody with Republican credentials who worked in the Department of Justice for many years, to oversee the investigation in multiple counties.
And that, that's Francis Schmitz, correct?
That's Francis Schmitz. He's a longtime Republican. He said that he actually voted for Walker. He was on George W. Bush's short list to be named a U.S. attorney for Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Won multiple awards and commendations from the Republican attorney generals under George W. Bush. This man is not an ideologue. He's conservative both in his disposition and in his politics. But he was by virtue of the fact that he was involved in this investigation into Scott Walker and into conservative groups, he's just been pilloried by the right wing media, by the Wall Street Journal editorial board, and others.
Pilloried as being partisan, right? As being a partisan witch hunt against Scott Walker and his supporters, his supposedly outside supporters, these outside groups, which brought millions, not just for Scott Walker's initial election, but then for his recall election and then for his re-election in 2014, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And that's what they were looking at here. Violations of the state campaign finance laws to the tune of at least $10 million by Walker working hand in glove with these dark money groups that don't disclose their donors. Evidence showed that Walker was going around the country telling donors that you can give to this dark money group that I'm working with, and the public is not going to know about it. Wisconsin has very strong traditions of openness, has had strong campaign finance disclosure laws, and by engaging in this scheme, it was really about keeping the public in the dark about who was supporting Scott Walker. And many of those donors, at least some of those donors, did receive special treatment from the Walker administration after he won his recall election. But the public never knew that the groups and individuals that were receiving the special treatment were major supporters of Scott Walker and major supporters of Republicans in Wisconsin.
They didn't know that because, as you described as dark money, that money that they gave to those groups where Scott Walker pointed them, those groups themselves do not have to disclose who is giving them money. Is that right?
Yeah. So it was a situation where Scott Walker knew exactly where the money was coming from, who was writing the checks, but the public did not.
How did he know if they're not allowed to coordinate? How would he know who was actually giving money to those groups?
because they were coordinating. He was specifically asking for donations. The individuals that he was asking were making donations to these dark money groups. And evidence indicated that Walker's campaign was then telling the dark money groups how to spend the money, how the funding was going to be most useful to the Walker campaign or to the campaigns of Republicans in the state. So it would have appeared to be a clear violation of the law.
Unless you change the law.
And that's in fact what happened. So just to get up to speed a little bit,
yeah.
So last July, Walker and other groups that were under investigation, namely Wisconsin Club for Growth and Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, which are the groups that Walker was accused of coordinating with, they brought a series of lawsuits, got it up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Wisconsin Supreme Court has a 4-justice majority, and that 4-justice majority was elected to the bench with $10 million in spending from the same groups under investigation, from the same groups that Walker was accused of coordinating with, the same group that were parties to the case, and the same groups that would be affected by an adverse ruling by a decision that what they did was illegal and that they could face penalties. The justices, two of the justices, were asked to recuse themselves. They declined and ultimately changed the law, rewrote Wisconsin's campaign finance law to allow this sort of coordination under investigation in this John Doe probe. They drew a distinction between issue advocacy, these ads that don't say vote for or vote against a candidate, and express advocacy, which are ads that expressly tell viewers how to vote. They said coordination over issue ads is just free speech. You know, coordination over express advocacy, that's a different story.
Okay,
that would still potentially be illegal.
And I want to drill down there a little bit, Brendan, but I want to underscore, Brendan Fisher, what you just basically described. You're saying that these groups, you named Wisconsin Club for Growth, and the other one was the, which one, Americans for Prosperity? Is that
Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce.
Okay, which
we're funded by this dark money. We know a lot of this money came from the Koch brothers related groups, as I understand it. So those groups got that dark money. They're supporting Scott Walker in his recall effort. And those same groups also supported with money these members of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, because in Wisconsin, the justices actually have to run for office, which to me, by the way, is absolutely amazing. But so they go out, they raise money or they run on their own. They put their own money into it. And then these so-called outside groups can also spend money. And you write in your article at Center for Media and Democracy how in at least two of these cases, two of these justices, that these outside groups far, far outspent the campaigns themselves, the justices' campaigns themselves. Those two justices, those are the ones that the prosecutors here who are investigating Scott Walker and this coordination and so forth, those two justices are the ones that they had requested recuse themselves from this case, from this lawsuit being brought by these outside groups?
Yeah, that's right. So those two justices, Justice Gableman and Justice Prosser, were both massively outspent by these outside groups, by these parties to the case. And that mm-hmm. raises serious concerns about conflicts of interest. It raises concerns about whether these justices could be impartial in a case involving their biggest supporters, in a case involving the exact same groups that, you know, you could, in large part, help put these justices on the bench.
And
but for the spending by these groups, these justices very well would not be on the bench.
Those justices are clearly beholden to those groups the same way Scott Walker is beholden to those groups. But why were those groups, those outside groups then, why is this case even at the state Supreme Court as far as what were they suing about? They were the ones being investigated. So why do they have a lawsuit that makes its way up to the justices that they quite literally, those same groups, had bought to put on the bench? What are they suing about? What's their problem?
Well, they were
getting away with
it. Because they were investigated. So we're going back a little bit. So this John Doe investigation started in 2012. As soon as the groups were hit with subpoenas, they filed these are well-funded organizations with national donors. They filed a series of costly lawsuits with high-powered attorneys from Washington, D.C. and from around the country.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, those cases went up to the Supreme Court. Against the Supreme Court, despite these conflicts of interest, these justices declined to recuse. They shut down the investigation, rewrote the law to benefit their biggest donors, and then the special prosecutor asked the court to reconsider its investigation, because even though they said that issue advocacy is beyond the reach of Wisconsin campaign finance law, the special prosecutor said, but wait, we have evidence of express advocacy. We have evidence of coordination between the Walker campaign and these groups over express advocacy, which in July you said would still be illegal. So I'm asking you to take another look at this, and allow us to continue the investigation in terms of with respect to express advocacy. But they went beyond that. Not only did they dismiss the motion to reconsider, they rewrote their July decision to say, you, special prosecutor, you can no longer be involved in this case, which means that he would be unable to appeal up to the U.S. Supreme Court and challenge the conflicts of interest on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which he has indicated that he has planned to do.
Which seems to just, well, absolutely unprecedented to me. But you're saying, so just to be clear, issue advocacy is put an ad on television that says Scott Walker is a wonderful human being and a great conservative in the tradition of Ronald Reagan. We love Scott Walker. Have a nice day. This paid for by such and such. That's issue advocacy, right? That
yes.
would be an okay. Express advocacy would be where those same people put something on the air, or perhaps, and they say, vote for Scott Walker. He's the one you want to vote for. Vote for Scott Walker or vote against his son of a gun opponent, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So one is allowed. You can say Scott Walker is wonderful and the living image of Ronald Reagan. That you can say, but you can't say go vote for Scott Walker. And what these groups were saying was, hey, we were just doing issue advocacy. We weren't telling anybody who they should vote for or against. So that's perfectly legal for us then to coordinate with the Walker campaign. And the state Supreme Court, who is funded literally by those same groups, they said, yes, that's right. But then the prosecutor, Francis Schmitz, comes forward and he says, no, wait a minute. We actually have evidence that there was direct coordination, that there was direct issue advocacy in these express advocacy by these groups. And that's why he wanted this new reconsideration of the decision.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, I mean, the court's distinction between express advocacy and issue advocacy in this context is also pretty unprecedented. It certainly does not follow. It certainly goes beyond any U.S. Supreme Court precedent. Even in cases like Citizens United, the court has said that there's not a clear distinction, or there's not a rigid barrier between express advocacy and issue advocacy when it comes to issues of disclosure. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if a candidate is coordinating with the group, asking donors to give money to the group, telling the group how to spend the money, the fact that the ads don't say vote for or vote against doesn't undermine the value of that spending to the candidate. Clearly, these expenditures are valuable to the candidate. Clearly, the candidate is going to be indebted to the donors to this group because they're coordinating. They wouldn't be working together if the issue ad spending was not valuable to the candidate.
And
it was a ridiculous distinction, but that is the distinction that the court created in July in the John Doe case.
And so would the special investigator otherwise, if he hadn't been essentially fired here, he would otherwise, or one of the prosecutors would otherwise, be able to go to the U.S. Supreme Court and say, hey, the decision that's been made back here in Wisconsin is inappropriate because the justices had a direct conflict of interest with the groups they were deciding on their behalf. But now, because of this decision that was made by the state Supreme Court, he can't do that because he's been essentially fired. How do they fire him in this decision? He goes and says, please reconsider. And they say, OK, we'll reconsider. And while we're at it, we agree we were right in the first place and you're fired. How did that happen?
It's extremely odd. And everything about this case, of course, has been very odd. So typically, a motion to reconsider or the response to a motion to reconsider would be, a page or two long. It would be a short decision, either granting or denying the motion. What they did here is basically issue a new opinion, not only denying the motion to reconsider on pretty shaky grounds, but also going back and rewriting their July decision at length with what appears to be the goal of preventing him from appealing this conflict of interest up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So this doesn't necessarily prohibit him from filing an appeal, prohibit the special prosecutor from filing an appeal, because if the justices should have recused themselves in the first place, if the U.S. Supreme Court finds that the justices should have recused themselves in the first place, then their determination that he never should have been appointed doesn't have any merit. The problem is the funding, how he's going to be able to pay for this appeal. So when he was appointed special prosecutor,
how did they take away
for the state?
I'm sorry. So he was actually working for the state when he was appointed as prosecutor. And if they end the case, if they say this case is over, this investigation is over, then his job is essentially done. He's no longer getting any funding to carry out his investigation. And therefore, even if he did want to take the time, the hours, the days, the weeks to appeal a case to the U.S. Supreme Court, now he would have to do it on his own dime?
That's right. And really, it's by rescinding his appointment that they cut off the funding for him, because this was an investigation led by elected county district attorneys. He was appointed special prosecutor by a state trial court judge. So it is the state that's paying him in this special prosecutor role. By rescinding his appointment, which the court did this last Wednesday, it means that he can no longer be paid. And bringing an appeal up to the U.S. Supreme Court is a very time-consuming endeavor.
Yes.
It's very complicated. And it's a hard thing to do on your own. It's a hard thing to do for free.
Yeah.
Especially when he's an individual. He's an individual who retired from the Department of Justice a few years ago. He's in private practice. Even though he is obviously invested in this case, he has to find a way to pay the bills.
Can the county? How about the prosecutors? You say that he's working with the county prosecutors. They're still on the on the state dime. Can they bring this case to the U.S. Supreme Court and say, hey, they've inappropriately shut down this investigation. These two justices should have recused themselves from the case. What is it? A 7-member court in Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's a 7-member okay. court. Although one justice recused herself for other reasons.
And
then sort of in another odd set of circumstances, that another justice died just over the past few months.
That's right.
Sad set of circumstances. So now it would be if the two justices had recused themselves, it would have been a 2-2 decision, a 2-2 tie. It would have likely gone back to the Court of Appeals.
To the lower court. So can the county prosecutors bring this case to the U.S. Supreme Court to appeal?
So in theory, and this is we get into the odd procedural issues here, but the county district attorneys were not parties to this case before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The Wisconsin Supreme Court denied their petition to join the proceedings. So currently, by rescinding the special prosecutor's appointment, not only does he not have funding, but there's really nobody in this case that's actually representing the interests of the public or the interests of the prosecutors. So theoretically, one of the county prosecutors could petition to be entered into this case. But for the Republican leaning counties, that's a risky endeavor because the John Doe has become so politically polarized.
Mm-hmm.
And then even for the district attorneys who are in less Republican districts, they have other things to do, and an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court is not easy.
And would they have to get approval?
Very time-consuming.
Yeah, would they have to get approval from the court itself? Then the same court to actually come into this case to intervene?
Yeah, they would. They would, which also is another complication. And then they're going to intervene, and just thinking politically, if these county district attorneys are going to probably. Or their office is probably going to appear in front of the court at some future date. So if you ask to enter this case for the purpose of bringing an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court to declare and asking the U.S. Supreme Court to declare that two of the justices should have recused themselves, that's a good way to piss off some of the Wisconsin Supreme Court justices. That you're going to be appearing from in the future.
Yeah, really, just a little. And I guess that's why you have a special prosecutor in the first place, so you don't run into those conflicts of interest, which at least two of the officials on the two justices think there is none. What conflict of interest? We can decide against the people who spent more money than our own campaign to put us into office. We can decide this case fairly. It's unbelievable. But okay, so Brendan, we have covered this now on this show many times as it's moved forward, as it gets insaner and insaner, and I have always contended that there is something much larger going on here, something larger at stake than just this local, state quibble over Scott Walker and his funding. What is really going on? I mean, Scott Walker is... he's not running for president anymore. He's been... I think he's termed out, isn't he, after two terms in Wisconsin?
No, there's no term limits, but it doesn't sound like he's going to run again.
Okay, so but he's won two regular elections. He's won one recall election. He's not running for president. But at this point, what is this really about? I think these groups and this fight and this lawsuit and this pushback against, fighting to allow them to coordinate with campaigns, just out and out full coordination, it seems like. With these campaigns, I think that this is a national effort in the guise of a state case. Is there merit to my belief, Brendan Fisher?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look, and you said that this has not gotten a lot of national attention, and that's right, at least in terms of mainstream media and media on the left. But if mm-hmm. if you look at the right, I mean, they are very, very incensed about this case. Mm-hmm. And on the right, national organizations, and in particular national funders, are deep-pocketed interest on the right, do see this as a test case. They see it as an opportunity to create a test case to strike down campaign finance laws across the country. They celebrated this Wisconsin Supreme Court decision, but also more specifically, the media campaign as part of this has been very concerted. There's been dozens of Wall Street Journal editorial board articles written about this. National Review has done a number of different articles about this. The Franklin Center for Government and Public Integrity, a right-wing, state-based network of news outlets,
funded, by the way, by those
hundreds of articles,
and funded by those same groups who are challenging
all
of this.
With both sides to the same group, yeah. under investigation in this case.
Yeah,
they very clearly have reframed this. This bipartisan investigation led by a Republican special prosecutor as a partisan witch hunt. They're trying to use this case as an example of the John Doe investigation as a supposed example of how campaign finance laws can be used as a cudgel to punish political opponents. They're using this as a way to argue against any campaign finance laws anywhere. And to support the arguments that they make against any sort of campaign finance regulation, and also to prohibit or to intimidate regulators or law enforcement officials from enforcing the campaign finance laws on the books, because they know that if a law enforcement officer or a prosecutor in another state is going to try and enforce the laws that are on the books, they're going to be hammered in the press, and they're going to be hammered in this well-coordinated media effort like we saw in Wisconsin. The same groups that were involved in this John Doe case are now trying to recall the Milwaukee County DA who was part of this investigation. They've dragged Francis Schmitz's name through the mud despite many years of service to our country, both in the Army and as part of the U.S. Department of Justice,
mm-hmm.
And all of it's entirely unjustified, but it's an effort to fight against any campaign finance laws and any enforcement of campaign finance laws around the country.
And this has to be noted that this is after Citizens United. This is after so many of these the existing campaign finance laws that we did have in this country, after those have been done away with. These groups on the right, and thank you for pointing it out, you're right, on a national level, on the right, they are paying attention to this case. They think they are under attack. They think their free speech is under attack because they're not allowed, it seems, to bring as much money as they want from whoever they want without disclosing it to anyone, and in a way that allows them to coordinate with the campaigns. They feel that our current campaign finance laws are too restrictive, that there is not enough coordination between these groups, that there is not enough money in politics. And I mean, at least as I understand it, and they're trying to set that precedent in Wisconsin, that I think will be carried to all 50 states, and potentially, is there an actual case here, Brendan, that could make its way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which would then just open whatever roadblocks are left in the campaign finance that would open it in all 50 states? Is there that path forward?
I don't think so at this point. There was a federal lawsuit that went up to the Seventh Circuit, and Judge Easterbrook, who's a conservative jurist, shut it down, said rejected their claims about the state of campaign finance law, and the group did try and appeal up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and there were some indications that the court might take it, but ultimately they didn't. So I think this is not something that's going to be this is not something that may have national relevance for other states in terms of a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, but the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision is certainly going to be cited in briefs by opponents of limits on money in politics in other court decisions. It may not be controlling, but it will be persuasive. But I think really more importantly, it's this it's a distorted portrayal of mm-hmm. what happened in this investigation that's going to be most effective in deterring lawmakers from enacting new campaign yep. finance regulation, in deterring law enforcement from enforcing the laws that are on the books. So we have to be diligent in pushing back on their false claims about what really happened here.
Yeah.
Because the assertions that you're seeing in the Wall Street Journal or in the Wall Street Journal editorial pages and from the National Review just don't align with the facts.
No, they don't. And boy, okay, I'm running really late, but I think this is really important because I think that this is, you know, as you suggest, going to be the precedent, going to be the template, if you will, in all 50 states to push back against any type of campaign finance law, campaign finance restriction. Brendan Fisher, in 30 seconds here, are we at a complete... I don't even know. Where are we as far as this case? Do we just not know how the prosecutor or anybody can move forward? Is this case over, or is there a way to get to the U.S. Supreme Court, or is it just a dead end? We don't know.
I mean, I think there's a good chance that there will be an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm hopeful that he'll find a way to bring it. I mean, in Wisconsin itself, it is done. The investigation is done, and even beyond what the court did, as I think we talked about last month, the Republican-led legislature rewrote the campaign finance laws to do away with even more restrictions. So Wisconsin is basically a lost cause right now, but there's still a possibility that this decision could get up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Although no one knows how that would possibly happen, it seems. Who would actually bring it, how it would be done, how it would be funded. Wow. Just amazing. Okay. Thanks, Brendan. I guess we'll have you back for the next beat in the story when it happens and we find out the next insanely amazing thing to occur out of the great state of Wisconsin under the rule of Governor Scott Walker. Just amazing. Brendan Fisher, read his full report and all of the really good work they do over there at Center for Media and Democracy at PRWatch.org. Thank you, Brendan.
All right. Thanks, Brad.
All right. A quick break, and we are back with more Bradcast right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned. Stopping the world to melt. Along with Desi Doyen. See, Desi, I told you we'd make it.
I'm very thankful and grateful.
I know. You thought we were running long there with Brendan. And,
oh, yeah.
And we were, but I knew we were going to get to the Green News Report since I screwed up yesterday and ran.
Well, that's quite all right. We got to get it in because it's a lot of important stuff.
I think so. All right. Especially with this climate conference now getting ready soon in the next day or two to wrap up. It's getting very, very exciting. So, and we may have an update in a moment, but let's run it. Our latest Green News Report.
This is the time. This is the moment.
Crunch time in Paris as United Nations climate talks seek global agreement.
Might that not scare people? Who
absolutely.
Think
Bernie Sanders proposes a national carbon tax. Goldman Sachs predicts exponential growth in renewable energy. Plus, good news.
Finally.
Global emissions decline in 2015, and not because of global economic recession.
All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Thank you, Trevor. As you know, we're all going to die.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, crunch time indeed in Paris. Will they be able to walk away with an agreement or not? Will the agreement be enough of an agreement to, you know, just save the world?
Well, that's a lot to ask for one agreement, but there does seem to be a lot of optimism right now in Paris in the final week of the United Nations climate talks, where high-level government officials from the nations of the world are negotiating a comprehensive international agreement to cut greenhouse gas emissions that cause dangerous global warming. Deep conflicts remain over how much money rich countries will give to developing and poor countries to prepare for climate impacts and to help them develop clean energy resources. Secretary of State John Kerry, speaking in Paris with U.S. media outlet Mashable, said he believes that reaching an agreement will unleash clean energy investment.
Setting the targets is a huge signal to the marketplace. And then the marketplace will begin, I think, to move into gear. And I'm quite confident that we're going to see a massive transformation in technology over the course of the next 5 years.
And in fact, even before any climate agreement has even been completed, investment bank Goldman Sachs has issued a major new report stating that they believe the global transition to a low-carbon economy is already well underway and projected, quote, exponential growth in the solar and wind industries over the next 5 years.
Uh-oh. Well, if Goldman Sachs is saying that, now I'm dubious.
Meanwhile, in U.S. presidential politics, independent senator from Vermont and Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders has released an ambitious new energy policy calling for massive investments in clean energy sources and instituting an economy-wide carbon tax on emissions. When CBS Face the Nation host John Dickerson asked if the idea of a carbon tax would scare people, Sanders said the impacts of climate change are much scarier.
We have a moral obligation to move aggressively to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy, and that is what my legislation does. So
right.
You want to talk about being frightened? I am frightened about the planet we're going to leave our kids if we don't act.
So the idea, and at least Bernie Sanders is saying it, is that you need to put a price on carbon. Somebody has to pay for all of this pollution that is now happening. And frankly, I'm convinced that the only real way to reduce those emissions is to make it so that it costs someone, so they have no choice but to lower the emissions to save money. It's a free market idea, frankly.
Yes, it's the idea that polluters pay rather than taxpayers for the pollution that they produce.
And right now, it's the taxpayers who are paying.
Right. Among other things, Sanders' plan would repeal billions in annual taxpayer subsidies to the fossil fuel industry. It would ban Arctic oil drilling, ban offshore oil drilling, ban fracking for natural gas, and stop exports of liquefied natural gas and crude oil.
That's a lot of banning, but is banning necessary if we institute the carbon tax? In other words, maybe they'll just stop on their own because it costs too much to produce.
I think the idea behind the bans is to keep it in the ground. Otherwise, those who can afford it will pay for it to be extracted.
So even with a carbon tax, some people will say, hey, no problem, I'll pay for it.
Right. Finally, some good news. Global greenhouse gas emissions rose only slightly last year in 2014 and appear to have declined in 2015. That's according to scientists publishing Monday in the journal Nature Climate Change. They say that if the trend holds and is confirmed, it would mark the first ever decline in carbon emissions in a year when the world economy was not in recession. The researchers say the new numbers may be evidence of changing behavior as more countries invest in renewable energy, such as solar and wind power.
Some uncommonly good news from you, Desi Doyen. And for much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Download our reports anytime via iTunes or Stitcher or TuneIn. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
This is the time. This is the moment.
Spread it across the country.
Can we go back? This is the moment. Tonight is the night. We'll fight till it's over. So we put our hands up like the ceiling can't hold us. Like the ceiling can't hold us. Can we go back? This is the moment. Tonight is the night.
So there you go. Some exciting news. Decrease in emissions for reasons unknown
least they're not
they're not established yet, and let's hope that it sticks. I mean, there's always a chance. Mm-hmm. This is going to be, it could be a temporary thing, it could be a fluctuating thing, but they believe it could be the inflection point. And if so, that is very good news.
That maybe we are just emitting less. We are using more renewables. We are using...
That the transition to clean energy has begun.
And to help that transition along in Paris, a bit of an update since yesterday. It looks like the parties to this conference, about 195 countries overall, have pared down the agreement by 14 pages. It was a 43-page draft. I think it's down to like 20-something now. That's a good thing, Desi Doyen?
That's a very good thing. That is basically when these agreements occur. They have bracketed text, which has multiple options, you know, three or four options that could go into that sentence. And so when they start removing those options and start narrowing down what the compromises are going to be, that is why the agreement has now been reduced by pages. They're meeting today. They're meeting tomorrow. They are meeting in overnight sessions. They are really, really going to work hard to create a really good agreement. But right now, there is still a very strong opposition from the developing nations and the small island nation states.
That would be us. We're developed.
Yeah, we're
not developing. Right?
The developing nations, the low-lying nations that are affected by sea level rise, the small island nation states, basically everybody else but the developed world is fighting very hard to lower that temperature target to 1.5 degrees Celsius, because anybody who lives within 1 meter of sea level rise will be probably wiped out by the end of the century.
As we discussed yesterday with Dr. Hugh Seeley from
Grenada. This is correct.
Yeah.
Yes. And so there's a big conflict right now. We'll see if over the next 48 to 72 hours what actually ends up in the agreement, and fingers crossed that it will be a strong agreement that will then also include mechanisms to ratchet up the ambition and the targets for every country. And they're looking for it to be a review period of every 5 years to do that. And Saudi Arabia and India are not happy with that right now.
Oh, poor Saudi Arabia and India. French Foreign Minister, Laurent Fabius?
Laurent Fabius.
Fabius, okay. Laurent Fabius, leading the talks out there, he says that the parties have now settled two-thirds of their disputes over wording, and says that constitutes progress. So we will see what happens in the next few days. We'll continue to keep our eyes on it. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, as ever. Thank you, Desi. To our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn. And, of course, to my guest today, Brendan Fisher of the Center for Media and Democracy. Check out their work at prwatch.org. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can always download it at bradblog.com. You can download it automatically over at iTunes, where we hope you'll stop by and give us a good review over there. Make it a little bit easier for everyone else to find the broadcast as well. Is that it? Oh, find us and follow us on the Twitters at TheBradBlog. Thank you very much for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is greatly appreciated. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.